And if you say four mantras on each one, what is that? Four times 21. Four times. Ooh. I had this ringtone at one time. There was one person who called me that was kind of heavyweight, you know, so it warned me that they were calling. Now it's for all the phone calls. Sorry, excuse me. Do you recognize that song? That was the theme song of some TV program about Chicago policemen. Your average ringtone. Yeah, right, it's not a ringtone. So what's 4 times 28? 112, so it's just over 108. So if you say 4 for each, or if you say 27 mantras, literally you can say, so you say, you can count that way, and then you know you've done 108. You imagine the syllable D on the tip of your tongue when you begin Om Arpatsanadi, and then when you say the 108, you imagine blessings from Manjushri coming to the D, and then as you swallow saliva, you imagine the D comes down to your heart chakra, blesses your mind. The little monks at the monasteries are advised in the morning, especially if they have trouble with wisdom, or if they have trouble speaking, sometimes it's difficult to say the words or something, this helps. First thing in the morning, before you say anything else, you can either do the blessing of the speech and do this is the first thing you do, or you can just do this if you don't do blessing of the speech. Okay? Make sense? Maybe not. So visualize in front of you the aspect of Buddha Manjushri. Generally, when we visualize the three places that you can visualize the emanation of the Guru Buddhas, in the space in front, about one body length at the level of your brow, on the crown of your head, or at your heart. Those are the three places generally are advantageous to visualize. So at the level of your brow, about one body length in front, small Manjushri, about the size of your outstretched hand, holding a sword and a text, emanation of all the Buddha's wisdom. Homage to my guru and protector, Manjushri, you whose intelligence shines forth as the sun unclouded by delusions or traces of ignorance, who holds to your heart a scriptural text symbolic of seeing all things as they are, who teaches in 60 ways with the loving compassion of a mother for her only son, to all creatures caught in the prison of samsara, confused in the darkness of their ignorance, overwhelmed by their suffering. You whose dragon thunder-like proclamation of Dharma arouses us from the stupor of our delusions and frees us from the iron chains of our karma, who wields the sword of wisdom, hewing down suffering wherever its sprouts appear, clearing away the darkness of all ignorance. You whose princely body is adorned with 112 marks of a Buddha, who has completed the stages achieving the highest perfections of a Bodhisattva, who has been pure from the beginning. To you, O Manjushri, I bow. Om Arpatsanadi, Om Arpatsanadi, Om Arpatsanadi, Om Arpatsanadi, Om Arpatsanadi, Om Arpatsanadi, Om Compassionate One, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind. Enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight into the Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. And then Manjushri also comes to the crown of your head, faces forward, diminishes in size to about the size of your thumb, and descends down through your little aperture at the top of your head, the Brahma aperture, through your throat chakra, to your heart chakra. And imagine your mind blessed, unified with the omniscient wisdom of all the Buddhas. How is everyone? Not too bad. I had an eye examination this morning, so I had to wear sunglasses for part of the day. Fortunately, my eyes are back to normal. So, any questions? Shankar, were you satisfied? Did you get a chance to listen to the...
I did. Thank
you. Shankar had sent questions. Let's talk about enthusiastic perseverance. He was in India. He listened to one or two of the MP3s, but then he listened yesterday or the day before to the other one last time where I tried to answer his questions. So that's good. Anyone else have questions? Yeah. Yes, I should say, rather than yeah. You're more polite.
This is probably very simple, but this primary mind that we're talking about, this is the same mind that follows the mind stream from one life to another?
Primary mind, well, there's different primary minds. There's the primary mind of our gross consciousness, which is right now. This is what we're dealing with right now. We're thinking and planning and remembering and having motivation, love, compassion, everything. This is our gross mind, and our gross, if you talk about the mental consciousness, that's the gross primary mind. But at the time of death, and when we sleep, or when you're in certain meditative actions, the gross minds absorb to the heart chakra. Certainly the senses do when you fall asleep. You know, in sleep there are different stages when you have rapid eye movement and then you have delta sleep. There may be some other kinds of levels, but in the delta sleep there doesn't seem to be any brain activity. We're not having dreams, we're not thinking anything, but still the subtle mind is existing. Meditators who have been able to cultivate the absorption of the elements and observe it in meditation during sleep, they can observe that clear light nature of the mind, subtle mind. So it has both a primary mind and secondary mental factors. And it's that primary mind that continues from life to life, not the gross one right now, because this gross one recognizes yourself as, I forgot your first name.
Elise.
You know, I'm Elise. But when your mind leaves this body, it doesn't think I'm Elise any longer. Just, where am I? I'm in the Bardo state, and then you take a new birth, and you recognize I'm a god, a goddess, I'm a cow, I'm a cockroach, or, you know, you wouldn't use words, but you identify with that body you've had numberless times in the past, and you take on that new life, and you make it another name. So it's not this gross mind, not this gross primary consciousness, it's a subtle one that continues on. Does that make sense?
I guess it what you're saying does make sense, but I'm still a little confused about the mind, you know, the primary mind that we're studying with its mental factors.
Okay, I thought your question was mainly, I misunderstood, I thought it was mainly about whether it was this mind that continued. So what about the primary mind?
The primary mind that we're studying that has mental factors?
Yes.
that primary mind is the one that travels throughout the different incarnations, or?
No, that's what I tried to answer.
Oh, okay.
This primary mind that you're observing right now, that thinks I'm Elise, who was motivated to buy me a Goodberries gift card, very kind, thank you. That Elise, that primary mind does not continue from life to life. At the time of death, that absorbs, just like at the time of sleep, it absorbs, but it absorbs completely to the subtle mind. There's no remnant of that gross mind any longer. The gross in the sense that it's gross compared to the subtle mind. The subtle mind, subtle most mind, is what continues from life to life. That's something that most of us don't have any experience of. We can imagine it. You know, if we do imagine the death evolution or something like that, the experience with the subtle most mind observing the clear light. It's that mind, that primary mind, and its attendant mental factors that continue from life to life. Is that any clearer?
So the primary mind that we're reading about, studying about, would then be one of the factors of that subtle mind?
The subtle mind, being all consciousness has both primary and mental factors, primary mind and mental factors. So it applies also to the subtle minds and the subtle most clear light mind. There is a primary consciousness of that, and it has attendant mental factors. It won't have any of the mental factors that are discursive, because that subtle most mind, the clear light mind that continues on, that primary mind, is not conceptualizing. It doesn't think, you know, it doesn't make plans. Now I'm in the clear light. Now I'm going to take rebirth. It's a mind without any of the certain of the mental factors. It will have feeling. It will have a certain kind of discrimination, but not discursive discrimination. It's just a, it's a subtle kind of mind. It will have memory, because you can train that subtle most mind to remember the meaning of emptiness and have that meaning of emptiness dawn on you while you're observing that subtle most mind. But it doesn't have other kinds of mental factors. So that's an explanation that's drawing some factors from Tantra to understand that. Lama Tsongkhapa said in his experience in understanding the sutras, there were certain facts from the study of Tantra that elucidated certain things about Tantra, about the sutra path. And there were certain things about the sutra teachings as distinct, when I say sutra, as distinct from Tantra, let's say the Bodhisattvayana, the Prajna, the sutras and so forth, certain things from that that elucidated subtle points about Tantra. So here's an example of certain topics from Tantra elucidating what happens at the time of death, what continues on from life to life. Because some of the lower schools of Buddhism say when we die, there's no intermediate state. Some of the schools say that the mind just appears somewhere else due to dependent arising. But other of the lower schools, Vaibhashika schools, the lowest of the Hinayana schools, others of them say there is a bardo, there is an intermediate state where there's a subtle mind and body and so forth. So anyway, it's a complicated subject. Okay, we'll leave it there. Okay, so last time we had finished more or less just a run-through of the object ascertaining mental factors, right? So we're going to talk about the 11 virtuous mental factors. So I'm going to ask, what's your name in the back?
Joey.
Joey may be a little exhausted because I understand he helped Venerable Khandro move her things today. But I'm going to ask, without looking, what are the 11 mental, virtuous mental factors? Do you have is there a microphone in the back? Okay, no, there's one in the front, one in the middle, and now one in the back. So you get, there's three, so there's...
Back there. Yeah, keep that back there, Joey. Don't look. Okay, you're just trying to prime up beforehand, okay? Yeah. Nothing's coming to mind? Just think of any virtuous mental factor. Is there anything that you know that's virtuous? Okay. This is good. This is good. Yeah. I bet Shanka might know because he's. Well, can you go through some of them anyway?
I remember.
Okay. One of them. Yep, you have to hold it. Yeah. after telling others. Okay.
Always remember shame and embarrassment because those are counterintuitive, but they're there.
Right.
Faith. Well, there you go.
Okay.
That's all that comes to my mind.
Okay, now you're not looking, right? Okay, so what can you add?
Wait.
Yeah.
Non-attachment.
Non-hatred.
Non-ignorance
or non-bewilderment. Yeah, so that's good to remember. The antidotes to the three poisonous minds. So in addition to faith, shame, and consideration for others, non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance.
Pliancy.
Effort.
Equanimity.
Conscientiousness.
And non-badness. Non-violence.
Ahimsa. You know, the famous... the same word that Gandhi popularized in India, ahimsa, nonviolence. Good, okay. So, like when I've asked you about the five skandhas and, the 12 links and people are, they jump all over the place or they can't remember. These are things that we should know. We know probably... Does anyone here knows how much is in their bank account right now? Come on, there's someone does. How much money? Okay, Wendy knows. $34.19 in case anyone wants to hit on Wendy for a loan. You can't exceed that. We know, mundane things, how much sugar should cost in the market and things, but we don't know the five aggregates, the mental factors. These are things that are better to fill your mind with, even if you don't remember the other mundane things. Reason is when you do meditation, say if you don't know the outlines of the Lan Rim and all of the factors, you have to have a book present. But if you have in your mind, you don't have to also always consult a book. You can just continuously meditate. You can call to mind all of these things. Anyway, just a suggestion. So that's good. We've got 11 mental factors. What did we have before? Five omnipresent mental factors. Five object-ascertaining mental factors. Now 11. That'll make 21 altogether. Okay. So, faith. Deva in Tibetan. So the nature of faith, here says the entity, that means the definition or the nature of faith. Compendium of knowledge, I think, is the how she is translating Amidama Samuchaya. Okay, question. So he's... is always in like this, in a sort of a rhetorical question. What is faith? It is a conviction, clarity, and wishing, or maybe you could say or wishing, with respect to an existent that is endowed with excellent qualities and power. It has the function of acting as a support for aspiration. So that's good. There's a lot of meat there. So there are three, generally there's three kinds of faith. There are probably many others, but these are the three main classifications. There is a lucid faith, she's calling here clarifying faith. Sometimes we call lucid faith. faith of conviction, that's pretty standard translation in a second, and wishing faith or aspiring faith. So what do these mean? Lucid faith, first of all, just the entity of faith. Faith is a virtuous state of mind that once engendered makes the mind limpid and clear and acts as a basis for virtuous activities. But it itself is a virtue. So if you can keep your mind, like say for instance when we choose objects of meditation, sometimes we choose Shakyamuni Buddha as an object of visualization or Tara or something in front. Have you heard? Concentration. So one of the advantages of that is if you are concentrating on something which you understand, that can induce in your mind a state of faith, when I say a virtuous object like that, like highest object like Buddha, and you are constantly creating virtuous karma. If you can keep your mind in a state of faith, you can prevent other kinds of distracting thoughts from coming, other kinds of discordant minds from coming. So faith is very important. You might think a faith is for the simple people, you know, but it's something very, very, that all of us need, all practitioners, even highly, you know, intelligent, so-called intelligent people. So clarifying faith, the three kinds. You say clarifying or limpid faith, clear faith. Conviction, faith of conviction, and faith, wishing faith. So here in the list, it's in different orders and in the definition. So clarifying faith is one like if you were to, there's a mythological jewel that you could put in the water after the king's horses, the army has run through the stream and caused the stream to become turbid. If you ever, you know, if you see the car going through the river or something, or after the flow of the river, all the mud is in the river, you put this stone in the river, in the water, and it becomes limpid. All of the dirt settles to the bottom. It's supposed to be one of the possessions of universal monarchs, something like that. So like that limpid faith, lucid faith, even there's other kinds of distractions, worry in the mind, generating lucid faith, these other factors are diminished. So how do you, is it just something you're born with? Is it like what people call blind faith? First of all, faith, as it's defined here, has to be a state of mind that's confident about something that does exist, that is virtuous. Okay? It is a conviction, clarity, and wishing with respect to an existent that is endowed with excellent qualities and power. So not just, you might say, I have faith in Henry Kissinger. Would that be this mental factor? That wouldn't necessarily be a virtuous mental factor, right? Because he's not endowed with excellent qualities and power. Someone might argue that he is, but that's what we're talking about here. Higher Buddhist, spiritual qualities. It has the function of being a support for aspiration. So lucid faith can cause the mind to become clear of these different factors in the mind. I'll read you what it says here. Clarifying faith is a clear mind engendered by seeing the excellent qualities of those so endowed, such as the three jewels. Why is it called clarifying or lucid? For example, when one places a water purifying gem in dirty water, the murkiness of the water is immediately cleared away. Similarly, when faith is generated, the murkiness of the mind is cleared away, whereupon all excellent qualities of realization become suitable to arise in one's continuum. So it's like a preparation. It's almost like I'm doing breathing meditation, you know, to clear the mind of other thoughts. Here, it itself is more than that. It is actually just having a state of faith in the excellent qualities of the triple gem creates virtue continuously while that mind is there. Faith of conviction is, clarifying faith can come partially just because of culture, because of your imprints in your mind, you might call blind faith. But it also comes about because of your karmic tendencies, seeing good qualities in someone and having faith in that, you know, in your teacher or in the Buddha or the Dharma. Faith of conviction is more deep. It comes about from analyzing the objects of faith and coming to your own confidence that this is an object to be revered. It is, the faith of conviction is something that's stronger. It, because you've analyzed it, it can't be dissuaded by other people saying, Buddha, right. Buddha, shmuda. You know, someone ridiculing your religion or something, and then, you know, as that person has some worldly power, you think, oh, all this time I thought this was good. Lucid faith itself, it doesn't have the same stability as faith of conviction. Faith of conviction is something where you've analyzed the objects of faith, the lucid faith. You've come to conviction about it. Does that resonate with you, the word conviction? Convinced. Yeah. Convicted.
I thought it was funny
that I first
heard conviction.
Oh, I thought it was conviction. Maybe you could say convicted. Sounds like prison. David Macklis mentioned in an email to me today, he said, we were going to have dinner on Sunday with his wife. He said, Karen just got back from the prison. And I was glad he added the word the, because of the... She does outreach, right? I think otherwise I could have. She just got back from prison. She had been convicted. But anyway, I understand what you're saying. So faith of conviction, as the text says, is the gaining of conviction through contemplating modes of dependent arising, cause and result, and so forth that are taught by the conqueror. Conqueror is, as you know, the Jina is an epithet of the Buddha who conquered all of the delusions and so forth. So faith of conviction is said to be something that we as thinking people should strive for, because then if someone were to impugn what we have faith in, we have reasons to counteract that. We're not going to be swayed by simple arguments that would criticize, you know, the objects of faith, there where our faith would be reduced. Wishing faith is having contemplated the modes of the Four Noble Truths, ascertained true sufferings and true origins as objects of abandonment and true cessations and true paths as objects of attainment, and having understood that these can be attained if one makes the proper effort, the faith thinking, I shall definitely obtain them. Well, let's put it more simply. If, for instance, seeing the Lama, seeing the Dalai Lama, seeing Lama Zopa, seeing the good qualities of Geshe La or other teachers, knowing that they have manifested to show us that these states are attainable, we can attain that. We can become like that. We can be patient. So this faith of appreciation or aspiration, here it says wishing, is aspiring to achieve these states. That state of mind is faith also. It's not just an aspiration, but these faith itself is said to be the mother of aspiration. All three faiths. I remember when Saddam Hussein said when America invaded, it was going to be the mother of all wars. I'm often thinking of that, the mother of all. Didn't he say that? And then we said something back. The father of all wars. So faith is the precursor to, it's a cause of aspiration. Aspiration itself is the cause of effort. And effort brings about, you know, the actual attainment of things. If you talk about development of the mind, effort is what brings about the mental factor, suppleness. Remember? You know, those of you studied concentration? Shankar, have you studied the faults of concentration and the antidote to those faults? I think five faults to developing Shine, the four antidotes?
Yes, I have studied them,
but... Okay, call them on that, okay. So, this starting with faith, leading to aspiration, which itself then allows you to develop enthusiastic perseverance, to develop shine, and that enthusiastic perseverance brings about suppleness, one of the mental, virtuous mental factors, which is then the direct cause of, you know, actual shine. So those are those are four antidotes to the five hindrances when you talk about shine. So faith is kind of like the mother of all aspiration. Why would you desire to observe karma or to understand emptiness or to develop bodhicitta? Because you have a certain amount of confidence or faith, belief, that these states are worth attaining, that they are attainable, that they exist, and you see them as virtuous and having good qualities and so forth. Okay? Make sense? So, that's important. So if there was an exam question, that would be probably one. You know, what are the three kinds of faith? If you learn the Tibetan, sometimes it's useful if you know Tibetan. If you don't know Tibetan, of course, it's not much helpful. Not very helpful, but... yeah. So this other text, Geshe Repton's text, translates them as believing faith, admiring faith, and longing faith. Wow, okay, a little bit different translations. Believing faith is what we're calling lucid faith. It's not a direct translation of the Tibetan or the Sanskrit. It is a state of complete conviction and certainty in such things as the qualities of the triple gem, the infallibility of the law of cause and effect. That is actually faith of conviction. The infallibility of the law of cause and effect is unshakable and cannot be enticed away by other propositions. Believing faith, I see. They translate conviction as believing. The faith of belief. Conviction sounds more precise to me. Admiring faith, which one is that? That's the one that's here, is called wishing faith. No, it's the first one, lucid faith. Admiring faith is a state in which the object of faith is held to be particularly excellent and dear. It is a mind endowed with a joyous and delightful quality. Longing faith is what we're calling here wishing faith, or faith of aspiration, is a state in which one has considered the object of faith to be attainable, and is thus characterized by a strong, interested longing to attain it. All of these act as the cause of aspiration, and all of them are virtuous. All of them cause the mind to be calm and to be free of other kinds of discordant factors. Here the author says he has merely identified some illustrations of the three types of faith. It is not that all instances have been exhausted here. Just like when we talk about the 51 mental factors, it's not as though all mental factors are included in those 51. If we talk about the 6 root delusions, 20 secondary delusions, it's not that all afflictions or delusions are included in those 20 secondary delusions. They're just the main examples, and the 6 root delusions, the main ones. So here, these are the main kinds of faith. So the next little section talking about faith, mistaking liking and faith, I think this is a little bit exclusive to the Tibetan language. Doesn't apply so much to English. We don't usually confuse faith with liking, do we? Okay, you can read that. You can read that. So then there's a question. Well then, are liking and respect the same, or are they different? Okay, again, this is a little bit valuable to read, but not so. It has to do with wordplay in Tibetan. Sometimes in the Tibetan scriptures, when the boys debate, a lot of the debates are centered on just minor verbal distinctions in Tibetan, which don't make a lot of sense to us. And if you get caught up in that, you can spend a lot of time. You'll know a little bit more about Tibetan grammar, but it won't necessarily help your Dharma understanding. So we will skip that. I'll let you read that. Faith is from the Formula of the Three Jewels Blaze, text says. Faith is the forerunner, and like a mother is the procreator. It guards and increases all excellent qualities. It dispels doubts and frees you from the four great rivers. The river of ignorance, the river of distorted views, the river of existence, and the river of craving. Faith signifies the city of happiness and goodness. Faith is without murkiness and clarifies the mind. It abandons pride and is the root of respect. Faith is the jewel, the treasure, and the best of feet. Like hands, it is the root of gathering virtue. Okay, some more quotations you can read. So it gives you a little idea about faith. Any thoughts as we skip to the next one about faith? You have any questions that you've always wanted to ask about faith? How can you develop faith? Is it just you either have it or you don't? How is that?
Well, you think about the qualities. I mean, if you're trying to develop faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, then you read about the qualities of the Buddha, their attainments, their,
right.
Their compassion.
You can develop those two, faith of conviction through effort. What about the lucid faith? He's thinking.
I don't know. I think it's a lot easier if you are given to understand or faith when you're not understand it, but given the idea of faith when you are a young child.
Maybe like that. But also, I think sometimes when people see the Dalai Lama, even they came, their wife or husband brought them, or boyfriend or girlfriend brought them, and they see the Dalai Lama. Sometimes there's some faith arises. Mm-hmm. Just when we see, of course, by charisma, you might say by charisma you see. Who is this? Someone, Robbins? Who is that guy that used to hear the courses? What is it? Tony Robbins, some course you might hear. Big teeth and tall and handsome and talking. Charisma, you might have what you think is faith in them or respect for them, but it's not real faith because it's not an object endowed with these transcendent qualities. But sometimes when we see them, our teachers, or just seeing their behavior over some period of time, not without a lot of analysis, that lucid faith can arise. And it arises, I think, a lot from seeds from previous lifetimes. Whereas the faith of conviction, there can be a certain conviction, but most of it comes about, as Shankar was saying, from analysis this lifetime. The faith of, longing to achieve these states comes about from contemplating them. That could have also a component from past lives and from analyzing this lifetime. Wendy?
I always thought that I have a lot of
back there.
There is. No, there's a third one in the back row, isn't there? Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, there.
I always thought that previous karma had a lot to do with the way we all responded to Lama Yeshe. If you never noticed, he looked just like Santa Claus. And
Okay. So
we all responded to him very positively, with no doubt, no hesitation, and I think that was the basis of
our
whole relationship.
I never saw
him as
Santa Claus.
Faith and delight.
Yeah, it could be. I think it's sometimes just seeing someone who's endowed with good qualities, and we have some, keep it back in that road there. Maybe put on that chair so that you're the possessor of that, so you be alert when a question is being asked. It could be, I don't know, it looked like Santa Claus. But anyway, you see good qualities in someone, and a certain amount of interest and faith arises depending on your karmic instincts in the past. Okay. So, next one, shame, and then the corresponding one of this embarrassment, they're translated here, Ngotsa Shepa and Telyoba. Shame is sometimes called consideration for oneself, and embarrassment is consideration for others. Actually, you could change these two names. I don't know, shame, does that always have to do with yourself in English, the definition of shame? Embarrassment, often, yeah, we're embarrassed what others will think, but that's, they don't really, these two words don't get right to the meaning. You might find even a construct like consideration for self and consideration for others as, or here in this text, self-respect and consideration for others. Maybe even though they're longer, they're not just one word, it might give you more of a flavor, because there might be some associations in your mind with shame and embarrassment that don't fit these definitions. So it's important to know the meaning. So as the Compendium of Knowledge says, shame is an avoidance of misdeeds on account of oneself. It has the function of acting as a support for effective restraint from misconduct. So what does that mean? That means taking your own self as the reason to avoid negative actions, you might say. It might partially be because of your ego. You know, I don't want to be seen, my reputation will go down if I do these negative actions. That's in a very gross sense. Or you can think in a more sublime sense. I shouldn't do these negative actions because I am a Buddhist practitioner. I am a representative of the Buddha or the Dalai Lama or the FPMT or Lama Zopa or something like this. Sometimes that kind of state of mind, just avoiding non-actions, trying to avoid non-actions, thinking I shouldn't be angry because I'm a Buddhist. That sort of is similar to this, but sometimes that is only repression. You have to apply the antidote to anger and these things. But simply having this mind, if it's applied before getting into all the causes of anger or attachment, it can prevent you from entering into them. Does that make sense to you?
It seems to me the reason they might be using the word shame as opposed to consideration of others is that...
No, this is self-respect, the first one, yeah.
Is that the idea of carrying shame is kind of like a guardrail to keep you from veering over into that those actions. So otherwise, shame seems like a strange title, but I can see how shame, you want to avoid carrying shame so you don't do these actions.
Okay.
Is that right?
The interesting thing is that we are still at the point where we haven't single-pointedly settled translations of Sanskrit and Tibetan words. The Tibetans took many centuries to come up with their Tibetan equivalents of Sanskrit words. Sometimes they weren't just an equivalent word. There was a new construction, like sangha. They translated it as gendun, gedun, aspiring for virtue. It's not even in the word sangha. Sangha in Sanskrit just means community, group. But they made a sort of a, what would you call that kind of translation? It packed into it is sort of the meaning of sangha, not just a group in general, but a group that's aspiring to virtue. So shame, also when we talk about shakpa in Tibetan, shakpa is what we often translate as confession. But the word confession in English, in the Judeo-Christian, let's say the peoples of the book, the peoples of the book are nowadays, I think that's a politically correct word, or it was the Abrahamic religions, I can't remember what word. The three. Okay. I know, it's okay. I just wanted to make sure everyone's on the same page. Confession there often has completely different connotations. It's like asking forgiveness of God in a certain case. In the Jewish religion, I understand, Jewish faith, you have to really confess, to purify through confession, you have to confront the very people you offended and receive their absolution, or else you haven't purified that sin. much different in Buddhism. The word shakpa might actually be called revealing. It's like when you have a log and you cut it open with an axe or something, and you see inside of it all of the things that are hidden otherwise. So opening up your heart and revealing what you have hitherto subconsciously or consciously kept from recognizing as negative. Recognizing negativity as negativity. You know, feeling remorse about it, wanting probably not to do it again, so forth. So the words are packed with different meanings. And so we have to be careful. You can't just assume that you know what something means but because you know the English word. You have to look at the definition. This is good what we're doing now. So self-respect, or consideration for self, or shame. Then its corresponding factor, embarrassment, or consideration for others. Embarrassment is an avoidance of misdeeds on account of others. Only one word different, on account of others, as opposed to oneself. It has the function of acting as support for effective restraint from misconduct. So the only difference is taking others as a result, as the factor. Say, for instance, if the Sangha were seen to be fighting or something like that, if there would be that tendency, and then they would, if this mental factor were to arise, consideration for others thinking, other people will lose faith in the Sangha in general, so this is not suitable for me to do. Make sense? Who's got the intermediate one? There's one in the middle there. Okay. There we go.
I just was looking in terms of your point about at the bottom of the page where you said, just as has been said above, shame is an avoidance of misconduct on account of others. So it's switched from embarrassment.
Yeah, no, it's a misprint there, right? It should say embarrassment is a... Yeah, because before it says, just as said before, shame is an avoidance of misdeeds on account of oneself. And then in this it says, just as has been said above, it should say embarrassment is an avoidance of misconduct on account of others.
Yeah.
Good point. Good catch. On the bottom of 35, the last line, there's a misprint. It says, shame is the avoidance of misconduct on account of others. She just left the word shame there. It should be embarrassment. So here's a discussion of shame and embarrassment. And as Shankar mentioned, shame and embarrassment are, you know, Nagarjuna in his letter to the king, giving advice to the king, talking about what a king should do, what kind of virtuous activities. These are the basis of all kind of virtuous activities, having a certain sense of respect for your own, I say, the fruits of your karmic deeds. I shouldn't do, so taking oneself as the reason. I shouldn't do this because, oh my gosh, I would experience great negative results if I did that. That's an example of shame. Or just what people might think of you. It's not just talking about what people think of you. Or taking what others, taking other people's well-being into account and avoiding negative actions for that. What is the difference between shame and embarrassment, or self-respect and consideration for others? Although both of them are similar in terms of avoiding misconduct, shame is such that when one is about to engage in misconduct, one avoids it thinking, this is not something I should do, that I should do. In the case of embarrassment, when one comes close to engaging in misconduct, one avoids it on account of others, thinking, if others were to despise me as a result of my engaging in this misconduct, this would be not fitting. That's only one example. One avoids misconduct due to concern about the displeasure of one's gurus or teachers, the principal objects of avoidance. So, for instance, one of the things we do sometimes is we imagine on the crown of our head Shakyamuni Buddha. If you practice guru devotion, you can think your guru in the aspect of Shakyamuni Buddha, always from the morning when you rise, always there as your witness. So, you know, you're about to steal another macaroon or I don't know what, you know. And what would your guru think? You know, so avoiding that, considering others, how others, you know, they would, George, again, another macaroon, you know. One avoids misconduct due to concern about the displeasure of one's gurus or teachers, the principal object causing this avoidance. So that's the other in that case. Can be other people also, not just gurus. The function is specified as acting as a support for effective restraint from misconduct, because shame and embarrassment are definitely necessary for restraining misconduct of the three doors, body, speech, and mind. Have you heard that expression before, the three doors? Three portals. If shame and embarrassment are absent, one will be unable to restrain oneself from any misconduct whatsoever. For, without fear about the fruition from one's own side, see, here it's talking about worrying about how it's going to mature, maturation on one's own aggregate, and lacking concern about the displeasure of one's gurus, teachers, and others, the community, the Dharma community. What will Christians think of Buddhists if we have dissension in the Sangha? What will, you know, the spread of Buddhism, how will that ever take place to benefit sentient beings if we have squabbles and fights, so we want to be restrained from negative actions, taking others into consideration? Very, very powerful motivation. There will be no way to cease from misconduct without these two. Okay, so that's very good. So what did we have? Faith, shame, embarrassment. Now we're going to talk about the negatives of the three poisonous minds. Do you know what, when we talk about the poisonous minds, what that means, the origin of that? You know the origin. Why do we call them poisonous minds? Well, and why are there only three? Aren't there 84,000 different delusions? Aren't all of them poisonous? Well, if you were to condense all of the 84,000 delusions into 26, you'd get the sixth root and 20 secondary. It can even be larger enumeration. If you condense those down, you get six root delusions. If you condense those down, you get the three poisonous minds, because whenever they're present, by their very nature, they poison our continuum in the sense that they are by nature negative, non-virtuous, by their very nature. It doesn't depend on any other factor. They themselves are non-virtuous by their nature. So they're called poisonous minds, just like poison, when you take it by its very nature, you know, acts as a danger to your body and so forth. So, first one, non-attachment. Second one, non-hatred. Third one, non-ignorance. And the important thing to know here is, it doesn't mean non-attachment doesn't mean simply a lack of attachment. Non-hatred doesn't mean simply a lack of hatred. Non-bewilderment doesn't mean merely a lack of bewilderment. If it were the case, right now, do you particularly feel any attachment in your mind? So we have to say there's non-attachment present in your mind because it's not there. That's not the meaning of non-attachment. Non-attachment, actually, there are three kinds of meanings of the negative particle mepa in Tibetan. Here it's called machakpa, Shedang Mepa, these negative particles, Timug Mepa, Ma and Mepa. Chakpa Mepa could also be non-attachment. One of the meanings is just the opposite of that. So the opposite of attachment. It's an antidote. Non-attachment is the antidote, positive antidote of attachment. Merely not having attachment in your mind is not necessarily virtuous. There might be other negative factors in your mind, right? Just not raising attachment just because you haven't come into contact or in the vicinity of an object of your attachment doesn't mean that you're in a virtuous state of mind. So what is non-attachment? It is a lack of attachment to cyclic existence. So here it just says a lack of attachment, but it means the antidote to attachment to cyclic existence. The here says the articles of cyclic existence. It has the function of acting as a support for non-engagement in misconduct. It is a knower that is disenchanted and lacks attachment. In Geshe Repton's book, when talking about, he calls it detachment. Does that mean anything different to you than non-attachment? Again, you might make note of these and see, weigh in your mind, which you like better. What bring? What, detachment? Sounds more. Do you think it's better in that case? More active, detachment. Whereas non-attachment just sounds like the lack of attachment, which is not just that. So detachment is a distinct mental factor that when referring to an object within conditioned existence, that means cyclic existence, right? Acts as the actual remedy for attachment towards it. Acts as the actual remedy. The definition in our text at this point doesn't mention that yet. It will in the discussion a little bit later. We'll talk a little bit more about this. Being removed from the object, it remains detached and does not, and one does not grasp for it. It has the function of preventing attachment and increasing the remedy for it. The remedy for what? Attachment, right? It has the function of preventing attachment and increasing the remedy for it. So there may be, detachment itself is a mental factor that's talking about the state of mind which is an antidote to the attachment that is detached from it, is not clinging to it. So when this mind is present, attachment has to, you know, as the detachment is rising through your logic, the attachment is going to go down. When the detachment is actually there, the attachment won't be present. They can't be present at the same time. Maybe to a certain extent they can, depending on the antidotes that you're using. Say, for instance, you may be tempted to engage in attachment for, let's say, drugs, beer. What do people like? Alcohol or cigarettes. Let's take something a little less. How many people here smoked at one time? Not that many. Okay. Okay, we'll leave that. Don't take the microphone here. So attachment, we might be attached to alcohol or drugs or different things. And in order to overcome that attachment, we have to use, we might use, what is it called, 12 steps? I was going to say 9 steps, 12 steps. Or from a Buddhist perspective, you might have to, is that not right, 12 steps? Okay, 12 steps. And, or from a Buddhist perspective, you may have to apply several different logical things. The attachment for the alcohol doesn't go down immediately, completely. As your antidote gets stronger through logic and analysis, the attachment will be going down. Generally, when you have an antidote like the realization of emptiness, it's like turning on a light in the room. The attachment goes immediately. But when we apply conventional antidotes, this is to say there's two kinds of antidotes, conventional antidote and ultimate antidote to the delusions. The ultimate antidote is the realization of emptiness, selflessness and emptiness. Selfless is a person, selfless is a phenomena. That's what we call emptiness, right? With that realization, it's like wisdom light. It understands there's nothing to be attached to. There's no ego that is the recipient of this intended joy that might be obtained through the attachment. There's no action of attachment. There's nothing to be done. That kind of antidote is an antidote for all of the delusions, all 84,000 delusions, all 26 delusions, all 6 delusions, all the 3 root delusions. When we don't have that wisdom yet, we need to have individual antidotes to each of the delusions in turn, like the antidote to hatred might be love and compassion and different things like this. Antidote to attachment might be various things. Impermanence, recognizing the impermanent nature of things, recognizing that it's not real suffering when we talk about contaminated happiness. Those are conventional antidotes. So with the conventional antidotes, as the conventional antidote starts going up, the delusion, the affliction starts to go down, right? So non-attachment is a state of mind that's being labeled to the any of those antidotes being applied, and that state of mind which is disenchanted and lacks the attachment. That state of mind, once the antidote is attained, is activated, is what's called detachment. Attachment is the tendency of the attachment. The delusion is a tendency of the mind that the desires to possess a particular object, whether it be animate, like friends and family, companions, or inanimate, you know, the new iPhone. You don't have attachment to the iPhone. I have to admit, I went to Best Buy to see the iPhone 6. I have some longing. I have to work on that. But it could be useful also. So you have to weigh. Bodhisattvas, for instance, are bodhisattvas always poor?
No.
Are they always rich?
No.
In circumstances where wealth may be of benefit to sentient beings, they actually accumulate wealth. Lama Zopa does pujas, wealth deity pujas and things to accumulate wealth, to build statues to benefit sentient beings. So, if an iPhone was beneficial, you know, you have to weigh these things. For as long as we allow ourselves to be subjected to its demands, the demands of attachment, we shall only obtain disappointment and suffering, never the satisfaction that we seek. Geshe Zopa used to say, when attachment rises in our mind, when anger rises in our mind, it's like a captain that we believe, you know, yes, sir. You know, eat that macaroon. Yes, sir. Does that make sense to you? You know, it's just, of course, you know, it's almost like it's your boss. And when you start to recognize these delusions, which is what we're doing, we're recognizing the delusions, or right now the virtuous mental factors, later the delusions. When you recognize these mental states, then you can recognize they don't have power over you. They're just states that have arisen, sometimes because of past karma, habituation, sometimes because of juxtaposition of some situation, meeting the object of attachment, for instance, influence of bad friends, all of these different things, karmic instinct. Then you have a way to apply the antidotes. You don't just immediately say, yes, sir. Geshe used to do that too. He used to salute. as though we're saluting to these things. They are our bosses. Thus, detachment is the opposite of attachment. It withdraws from a compulsive involvement with the object through an understanding of its true nature. Thereby, it eliminates grasping and clinging to possess. Being under the influence of attachment, we find ourselves driven here and there in the pursuit of transient pleasures, lacking any real value. With detachment, though, we are enabled to see more clearly and objectively, and thereby focus our attention and energy on accomplishment of truly worthwhile aims. So I'd like to think also, the more attachment you are, the more attached you are to things, to your own happiness, the more needy you are. Do you use that word in every language? Do you know some needy people? Can you think of anyone? You know, say, oh man, so-and-so is really, you're laughing, you must know. we might recognize. And the poor person, you know, they're so needy, they have to be the center of attention, they need so much. And you can see by their compulsive neediness, when we see it others, we recognize they have little space to help others because everything is centered on them, egocentric. And in our own lives, the more needy we are, the more attachment we have, the more self-cherishing thought we have, the less time there is to read read the Dharma, to practice the Dharma, to meditate, to think about others. When you daydream, what do you daydream about? Oftentimes we will find ourselves daydreaming about something that's pleasant to us. You know, some erotic fascination, or, you know, becoming famous, or, you know, becoming a famous baseball player, you know, whatever your daydream, to play the piano and entrance others or something like that. Winning the lottery. How often do we daydream about accepting the defeat? Bringing real happiness to others while humbly not taking the credit for it. You know, being in the background. Could happen, yeah. I try more and more to have these kind of daydreams, or when I go to sleep, you know, when you're just sort of like, before you actually fall asleep, to try to have a virtuous state of mind. So having these states of mind, once you know what virtuous states of mind are, try to engender them at the time of falling asleep, because the whole sleep process will be affected by what motivates it, what comes at the very beginning. So if you motivate the sleep with, you know, bodhicitta motivation, or even just one of these virtuous states of mind, this whole sleep can become virtuous by the force of that. Does that make sense to you? Okay. So non-hatred. Again, here it calls also non-hatred. It doesn't mean just a lack of hatred. It is a lack of, although it says here, it's a lack of malice with regard to sentient beings, suffering, and the sources of suffering. So there's three things. The suffering itself that you might get angry with. Shedang, here it says shedang, hatred, shedang, mepa. The usual word for anger that we translate as anger is kondro. Anger is one of the root delusions. Here it says shedang. Do you know the difference between hatred and anger? Do you know? Okay, what would you, again, when we get into the realm of just what our personal meaning is implied on those books, what do you sense the difference is between anger and hatred?
Well, that anger could arise, not necessarily, well, I guess that's not true.
Paul, I think, yeah. Who's got the thing back there? There's another one back there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Wendy, yeah, you're supposed to have consideration for others. Okay, there it is. You have to turn it on.
Okay, you can be angry at your children. You certainly don't hate them. But, you know, if they're behaving in a way that's going to cause them harm, you can get angry.
Yeah, so what does that apply? So I agree with you. So I think the way that it's translated is quite good, because anger, we usually think of anger that might be something short-lived. I got angry, but hatred sounds like something that's longer-lasting, right? I really hate this or that, you know? So, indeed, that's generally what it's meant. Hatred is something that is, Dalai Lama says the same thing, hatred is something that's long-lasting. He said, when I was a kid, when I was a child, and even now, he says, I get angry sometimes, but it goes away. But hatred, I don't have. I don't hate the Chinese. So sometimes kondro or anger might be something that you can't control so much as it just comes up, you know, although we should be able to control that by training the mind. Okay, so non-hatred, it's a lack of malice with regard to sentient beings. Those are the instigators, let's say, of the suffering. If they're like someone has done something to beat you. Suffering and the sources of suffering. So say in the case of being beaten with a stick or a hand, the sentient, you might be angry at the person, you might be angry at the fact that you are suffering, or on the source of the suffering, the hand or the stick. Shantideva says in the chapter on patience, I think, why get angry at the person? The person is not directly harming you. It's the stick. You should get angry at the stick. Right? Right? It doesn't say that, Paul?
I thought the implication was mainly you should be angry at yourself for being hurt.
Yeah. Well, there's some other things, but when we're talking about
motivation.
This, you know, should you be angry? What is the direct cause of the suffering in that case? It's the stick, right? Well, if you're angry, then the person will say, but the person is the one who's motivating the stick. And then the answer, your good devil, your good angel's advocate instead of the devil's advocate says, oh, well, in that case, if you want to say you should be angry at the person rather than the stick because the person is wielding the stick, then you shouldn't be angry at the person. You should be angry at their anger. That's what you're thinking of. Their anger. And try to destroy it rather than destroy the person. So out of compassion, you know, so like that, something like that.
Yeah, but he also says something about, you know, who should I be angry at, my arm or his sword?
Oh, yeah, I haven't heard that one. Okay, that's something I'll have to think about. Okay, so the three specific objects mentioned in this definition in Geshe Rapten's book says, someone who is actually inflicting harm upon us is one thing. The harm itself, we can get angry, you know, oh, this darn pain, or some more strong expletive. Can you be angry at pain itself, suffering? I hate that. I hate people commit suicide because they can't bear the pain. They hate the pain, right? And the third thing, the cause or instrument of harm, thorns, poisons, weapons. I'm recognizing one of these three things is the cause of our suffering. We tend to dislike the thing and subsequently become angry toward it. This anger immediately causes agitation and tension in the mind that leads only to irrational and uncontrolled behavior. Non-hatred is the opposite response. Without blindly reacting to the situation, it maintains a clarity of mind characterized by love, kindness, and patient acceptance. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Non-ignorance. The other text says non-bewilderness. Bewilderness, because here it doesn't say avidya. You know the word avidya?
Non-educated.
Pardon?
Uneducated or not having enough knowledge.
Yeah, ignorance. So what we in Tibetan, avidya. A is negative. Vidya means knowing. So not know, like you say, not knowing, but we often translate it as ignorance. Here it's not non-ignorance, you know, marikpa mepa or something. It's timug mepa, which is another word, moha in Sanskrit. Do you in Pali? I mean, in Hindi, was moha mean? Okay, not from the Buddhist perspective, moha is more like confusion. Sometimes translated, people call it delusion, but that is too broad a category. Moha or timug in Tibetan. This is non-timug, non-moha, amoha. It's a state of mind that is the antidote to moha, the antidote to timug or bewilderment. It's not exactly ignorance. It's related to that, but it's called non-ignorance in our text. It is a knowledge arisen from fruition, scripture, contemplation, or realization, and is a wisdom of individual investigation. It has the function of acting as a support for the non-engagement and non-misconduct. These three all help us to avoid engagement and non-misconduct, as did shame and embarrassment, right? So it says it's arisen from fruition. That means this kind of non-bewilderment or non-ignorance, antidote to ignorance or to bewilderment, arises because of karmic maturation or fruition from previous lives. Some people have a natural kind of wisdom that's inborn, excuse me. It can arise from scripture, from reading, from contemplation, or realization.
Do you have water up there?
I do. Sorry, I was just hiccuping. I think my throat is okay, but excuse me.
Ah.
So here, I'll read you Geshe Repton's thing about non-bewilderment. Is a distinct mental factor that arises from either an inborn disposition, what does our text say?
Fruition.
That would be inborn, right? Either inborn disposition, learning, reflection, or meditation. So that's generally, when we say learning, that's often what we translate as hearing. Hearing, contemplation, and meditating. Three kinds of wisdom. Wisdom also arises from karmic imprints from past lives. Sometimes by praying to Manjushri, you leave the imprint in your mind to be wise in future lives. So to be wise now, you have an imprint in your mind of non-bewilderment. It acts as a remedy for ignorance and accompanies the firm intelligence that thoroughly analyzes the true nature of objects. So in other words, this state of mind is imputed upon the antidote to bewilderment, to ignorance, that is accompanying wisdom, that's analyzing, let's say, impermanence or ultimate nature or the Four Noble Truths. As you understand, as you're analyzing it, you have that wisdom, this mental factor, which is the exact antidote of bewilderment and ignorance that's going to be following them, is activated. So they're going to be simultaneous. It acts as a remedy for ignorance and accompanies the firm intelligence that thoroughly analyzes the nature of objects. So in other words, they're going to be simultaneous. They're going to be in the same retinue of a primary mental consciousness. Non-bewilderment has the function of preventing bewilderment, increasing the four types of intelligence. What are the four types of intelligence? Oh, I just said inborn. The wisdom arisen from hearing, the wisdom arising from contemplation, the wisdom arising from meditation. What's the difference? Okay, we'll talk about that later. And acting is the empowering factor in the actualization of wholesome qualities pertaining to purification. Non-bewilderment is a clarity and sharpness of mind that dispels bewilderment. Because sometimes bewilderment, moha, is called murkiness, or you know, like dark mind. It dispels bewilderment about a particular object. Bewilderment is like the darkness in a room, and non-bewilderment is like the light that clears it away. It itself is not a form of intelligence, but is a lucid quality of mind accompanying intelligence that bears a relationship of similarity with either enthusiasm or concentration. Very interesting when you read the details. So non-bewilderment itself is not the wisdom, but it's a factor of lucidity that comes in the mind accompanying wisdom. When wisdom is there analyzing and you see things clearly, then naturally this lucidity arises that counteracts bewilderment, the darkness of mind. Most of us are born with a certain degree of non-bewilderment inherited from previous wholesome activities. So that's what the inborn, or what was it called, fruitional, right? Nevertheless, for it to aid us in gaining liberation, it is a quality that needs to be heightened and developed firstly through learning, that means hearing and study, subsequently through reflection or contemplation and meditation. When the Dalai Lama talks about, when Lama Tsongkhapa talked about, you know, at the end of a text when he explained himself, he didn't say the great meditator or the great Lama or anything. He just said, you know, the bhikshu, he gave his name from Tsonga or something like that, who has heard much. So has had much hearing, who studied a lot. And you might think, well, that's okay. But that is, when we talk about wisdom, that's the first thing we need to do to develop our wisdom. We need to hear the teachings. It can, in under the word hearing or learning, includes both hearing and reading. So when you read, hear actual discourse where you're in the presence of someone explaining the Dharma, that at that very moment when you understand the words, a certain kind of wisdom understanding arises. You understand the words. But there could be certain contradictions in your mind. It's not completely clear. In order to solidify that, you contemplate that. You weigh that. You do analytical meditation about that. And a deeper state of wisdom arises, a wisdom arisen from contemplation. Right? That becomes very strong. But that does not necessarily lead to a deep realization. What you need to do is then focus on that single-pointedly, on the conclusion of that analysis. This is a theme I've been mentioning on the Sunday classes and other things. You hear the teachings and you contemplate them. You do analytical meditation. And then when you come to a conclusion of the analytical meditation, you hold that conclusion single-pointedly to leave an imprint in your mind. It's that stage that a new kind of wisdom arises, the wisdom arisen from meditation. Really, wisdom arisen from meditation is qualified by being accompanied by actual union of shine and lakdon. What do we call tranquil abiding and penetrative insight. That is when you have actual wisdom arisen from meditation. But in our case, when you hear Geshe-la's teachings, or you read the texts, or read the Dalai Lama's books, and you have some understanding, you contemplate that, you weigh it in your mind, you try to see it from all ways, and yeah, that makes sense. When you get that feeling, holding that flavor, that conclusion, single-pointedly, then a deeper kind of insight arises called the wisdom arisen from meditation. So inborn wisdom, wisdom arisen from hearing, from contemplation and wisdom, from meditation. These are the four kinds of wisdom. It should be noted further that the terms detachment, non-hatred, and non-bewilderment did not denote a state of mind that simply lacks attachment, hatred, or bewilderment. The negative prefaces are not indicating a simple negation of these mental factors. Rather, they are denoting the converse remedial mental states for them. Converse, is that the right term? The opposite. The detachment, non-hatred, and non-bewilderment are affirmative phenomena that have a wholesome remedial effect on the side. Okay, so when you say, generally when you say non, like when we talk about shunyata, the Prajnaparamita in one syllable. Did you hear the Vajra Cutter? You said you heard the Vajra Cutter? Oh, you didn't. So there's one Prajnaparamita called the Prajnaparamita in one syllable. Ah. Ah in Sanskrit is what? Negating particle, right? Ah. There's other. On, before the word Atma, you have to put on, Anatma. But generally, ah is a negative particle like non. And that just means no. But these ahs here don't refer to that, just that lack. They're referring to a positive phenomena. The lack of emptiness is a non-affirming negation, right? It's a negative phenomena. Doesn't affirm anything in its place. Whereas these are not negative phenomena, these three roots of virtue, you could say. You could say the three roots of non-virtue are bewilderment, attachment, and hatred. These are the three roots of virtue, you might say. These three states of mind. Now, I've gone over a couple minutes, but I want to just go a little bit further into your study time, just so we have a chance of finishing this up. So I'm going to skip over this section where it's talking about the sets of discourse, what the wisdom arisen from hearing contemplates, the scriptures, all of these divisions and everything, and go to page 40 and near the bottom, effort, the next one, effort. Sundru. Do you know what that is in Sanskrit? Anyone? Virya? Virya, energy. But here, it's not any kind of energy. Like someone, you might say, someone has a lot of enthusiastic perseverance, or that's one way you can add an extra word to give it more precise. Enthusiastic perseverance. Even then, you might say, I have enthusiastic perseverance for watching every episode of The Sopranos, or I have enthusiastic perseverance to follow the Tar Heels, or to eat ice cream or whatever, you know, to have sex as much as possible. Yeah. Oh man, he has so much enthusiasm, energy to steal money. Those don't fall under this mental factor. This is a virtuous mental factor. So we have to understand effort or enthusiastic perseverance, virya, is a mind that is enthusiastic in regard to, to armoring, application, non-inferiority, irreversibility, and non-complacency. It has the function of fulfilling and accomplishing the class of virtue. So more simply, enthusiasm is a distinct mental factor that acts as a remedy for laziness and joyously engages in wholesome activity. Here's the important part. Joyously engages in wholesome activity. So for instance, if we joyously engage in negative activity, that is not considered enthusiastic perseverance. That's actually the opposite. That's actually laziness. So the people who have, you know, they have so much money so much energy or joyous effort to accumulate money. You know, you read, who was this fellow today? Not to impugn him. Henry Greenberg or someone?
Maurice Greenberg.
I think they call him Hank somewhere. But who was the chairman or somehow owner of AIG, is suing the government for what? Sanka, $15 billion or $25 billion? Because even though the government bailed out AIG, he thinks that the repayment of that loan was too high an interest rate after the government paid $280 billion for a company that was only worth $15 billion. Anyway, so here's an example of a person who has much energy to get every last cent, you know. You might say, well, he's like a proto-Buddhist. He's got so much energy, you know. That's not considered enthusiastic perseverance. That's actually, there are other negative factors involved in that state of mind. Greed and so forth, and pride and hubris, and what do the Jewish people say? Chutzpah. But particularly, it's also laziness. Laziness is of various kinds. One of the kinds of laziness is laziness that is attached to samsaric happiness. And that becomes what we often think of as energy, you know, pursuing money and pleasure of the senses, becoming a connoisseur of wine, and you know, all of these kind of things. I don't mean to criticize you if you were a connoisseur of wine, if you're listening to this sometime in the future on the MP3. He said Buddhists can't enjoy wine. I'm not saying that. It can be kind of a laziness, okay? So what is effort? It's a mind that is enthusiastic in regard to armoring, application, non-inferiority, irreversibility, and non-complacency. More simply, these are different kinds of laziness that it is, that are actualized by that. All wholesome aspects of the path are developed by means of enthusiasm. It is through its activating force that liberation and Buddhahood are realized. I remember when I went to college, I went to a very competitive college, and there were in sort of technical school, and there were some people who were just flat out brilliant. That my roommate when I was a freshman, we called him C-cubed, Charles Claude Councilman III. I wonder if Charles will ever hear this. C-cubed, yes, this is MIT, right? And Charles, he all year long, he wasn't lazy, he was very bright, did all sorts of interesting things, but he never studied. The night before the final at MIT, in the honors division in electrical engineering, he'd be studying, and he would get the highest grade in the text. And it wasn't just like knowledge that stayed for a short time. He, for his senior thesis, he had devised the algorithms that were the basis for our GPS melt. It's how you can find your position on the Earth from signals from through satellite. Very complicated, brilliant guy. So there's some people who were, you know, did well that way, but there were some people, not myself, who were, I remember someone in our house, George Eldis. So George was not as bright, but he had so much enthusiastic perseverance to study, energy. So he studied all year long, did pretty well. But enthusiasm to achieve enlightenment is not enough just to have some brilliance that you're going to achieve enlightenment. We need to apply ourselves. Enthusiasm is like the fan that, you know, what do you call it? Fans the fire. It is effort that fans the accumulation of all of the virtuous qualities. So it is not without meaning that it is one of the prajna, one of the paramitas, the practices gone beyond, or the six perfections, right? Do you know the six perfections? Yeah. Out loud, quick, loud, in order. Generosity.
Morality.
Patience. Effort. This one.
Concentration.
With, okay, you know, one set. That's great. I'm really proud of you. There's something that you've memorized. If I asked you the five aggregates, it was not so good. 12 links or other things, but that's good. Okay. I'm going to just see if there's something else. So there are three kinds of laziness that we can understand here. That enthusiasm is the remedy for, the antidote for. The first kind of laziness is the idleness or laziness of sloth. Is the laziness of idleness or sloth. Isn't that one of the six deadly sins or something? Or how many sins? Seven. That's right, seven. I just saw that advertisement for that old movie, Seven. What is sloth? What is meant by the laziness of idleness or sloth? Do you know? Not just from what you know from sloth. Sloth kind of just...
Dullness.
Yeah. Just like not getting up to do anything. We sometimes just feel sleepy and we don't engage in virtue because of that. We don't have the enthusiastic perseverance to joyously engage in virtue. Enthusiastic perseverance means joy to engage in virtue. That's important to know. To be happy about it. If there's a puja, try to generate the enthusiasm. To be joyous about it. Not just saying, I've got to go. That's okay. But to be joyous about it. So this kind of laziness of idleness or sloth is a dull quality of mind that lacks any interest in the Dharma and simply wishes to sink into an indifferent state of sleepiness. The second laziness is that of self-pity, self-deprecation, right? I'm so dizzy, or ditzy, what is it? I can't understand the Dharma. You know, other people can. This becomes manifest in thoughts such as, I am so inferior that I could never attain any insight or liberation. It is a needless indulgence based on deprecation of one's own potential. Do you ever sense that? What else do we call it? Oh, what is the word? What do psychologists say? Low self-esteem. Exactly. Low self-esteem. So the laziness of low self-esteem, thinking I can't do this. There is an offshoot of that, another division of that mentioned in the Prajnaparamita, thinking, not focusing on that I can't do it, but just say it. Numberless sentient beings, numberless world systems, numberless delusions to overcome. Forget about it. You know, I'm not capable of doing that. So it's an offshoot of this self-deprecation, and has a separate antidote for that in the Prajnaparamita. The third is attraction to evil, laziness. It is often confused with enthusiasm, since it too is characterized by perseverance, but perseverance toward that which is unwholesome, like getting money, like Maurice, Greenberg or whatever. All efforts we make toward accomplishing worldly goals, even when they are joyfully undertaken, are in fact a form of laziness. That's interesting. Think about our own lives. What we're being lazy at that time when we're just, you know, following our own delusions. Perseverance toward that which is unwholesome. Thus, an awake, diligent state of mind is an enthusiasm that counteracts idleness or sloth. A wholesome perseverance based on self-confidence is the enthusiasm that overcomes self-pity or low self-esteem. And the finding of joy in what is wholesome is the enthusiasm that eliminates attraction to evil. Finding joy in what is wholesome. So, I'll just mention these last ones. They're still to talk about suppleness, conscientiousness, equanimity, and nonviolence. So, next time, if you can go over those and go over the six root delusions and start to look at the list of the proximate afflictions, the 20 secondary delusions or afflictions, we will continue from there. Yes. Oh, yeah. So when we talk about enthusiasm, enthusiastic perseverance, we might think that means if you're really a Dharma practitioner, you've got to be at it all the time. 24/7, 365, 85. How many years you can live? You know. But as Shantideva mentions in the Bodhisattva Charivatara, it's mentioned in the scriptures, if one's goal is to really accomplish the Dharma, to actualize it, you need to have a long practice for a long period of time. If you put too much effort right away, you can burn yourself out. Burn out, imperil your own health, imperil your mental stability. And in so doing, you make yourself susceptible to other karmic influences in your own continuum and outside influences like spirits. There have been people I know, I've been in the presence of them, had so much enthusiasm to practice. Meditating for many hours, not taking rest, not taking vacation, not even eating very much. And in so doing, they were afflicted by spirits. And when that happens, that's very more difficult to, you know, you can't get over that very quick. It's not like taking a medicine or just doing one puja or something like that. When we were in one cemetery in India, one of the eight great cemeteries from the time of the Buddha, the charnel grounds, we call them cemeteries now. You know what a charnel ground is, where the bodies were put, jackals and birds would come, jackals. What do you call them? The big birds that vultures and so forth would eat the bodies, or dogs. And there was one boy who had become a monk and was so strict, and he had started to do strange things, like he was starting to do Tai Chi or Qigong, and he never studied it. It was as though he was possessed sometime. And at one point during this pilgrimage to the cemetery, he started beating his former girlfriend, who was a nun. And another monk and I went to try to intervene, and she started running away, and he was running after her. We were running through the brush, cutting up our legs and stones and everything, and they were heading toward a precipice. We were really afraid she was going to fall or he was going to chase her. He was completely possessed at this time. And We finally grappled him just before we actually heard, you know, flesh on flesh, him beating her, and we grabbed him and we put our malas on his head. Sometimes, you know, when you say mantras, do you blow on your mala at the end? Some blessing. So that actually had some, calm down. We brought him to Kirti Senchap Rinpoche, who was our acting guide at the time. And Rinpoche took the aspect of first saying some wrathful mantras, Yamataka or something, to get rid of this. Nothing happened. And Rinpoche said, can you give me a canteen? Someone gave him a canteen with a cap on it, poured some water. He said, one rosary of Omani Pemi Hung, blew on the water, poured it in the boy's mouth, who still, everyone is holding him down, and he said, and he explained later, in the presence of the boy, when he was, more calm, that this was a spirit influence because he'd been pushing himself too much. And that when you do that, sometimes the black spirits have a hold over us. When your accumulation, you're trying to practice Dharma, and you anger negative spirits. You know how we talk about spirits that are conducive to the Dharma and those that are antagonistic toward it? So if you don't have a big accumulation of merit, they can afflict you, afflict your health, afflict your mind, and he gave various remedies to him. Also, Shantideva says in the Bodhisattvacharya Avatara and in the Siksha Samuchaya, which is a commentary that Shantideva wrote, he says, this human rebirth that we have as proto-bodhisattvas, we've offered to sentient beings. This is like, this belongs to sentient beings. If we don't take care of it, we're a derelict in our duty to help sentient beings. This body and mind combination, if we let it go to waste because we're sick, we're burned out, we are not able to continue to practice continually. So it is the wise person who wants to be enthusiastic in the practice of Dharma, who realizes there is a time and place to rest, to retreat away from the activity, certain things that are not important. That's very important. Certain things we might get involved in at the center or other places that we think are really important, but they're not so important. We have to analyze. And we might spend so much time on that we don't have time for our own relaxation. I don't mean, relaxation mindless, but just the healthy relaxation to keep us healthy. I mentioned to someone outside, I think Donna, Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe used to have this kind of like a tag team kind of thing. Like comedians, one person acts as the fall guy. What do they call it? The straight man? Yeah, the straight man. So Lama Zopa would be the straight man. Once when I had a tape recorder and I was taping Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa came out of his room. Did I tell you the story? He was, he'd been meditating for so many hours, rubbing his eyes and, oh, tape recorder, this is wonderful, this is fantastic. Peter bought a camera. What can you do with a camera? And he's going on and on like this, And Lama Zopa Lama Yeshe looks at him and says, depends on what you do with it, Zopa. There's nothing that's inherently good or bad. Actually, camera's wonderful. You can take pictures of Tonkas and so on. Tape recorders are also good. But there was one occasion I remember when Lama Zopa was anxiously going out to give teaching. Someone had requested teaching, was going to go out in a cab somewhere. And Lama Yeshe said, check up. Is it beneficial, Zopa? Something like that. He always calls Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Zopa. And so Rinpoche took the aspect of being chastised. All of these were for us. It wasn't for Lama Zopa. He was the straight man. He was the foil that was allowed Lama Yeshe to give advice to us without offending us. Do you understand? So you have to check if it's important. And you may think certain things are important, but you have to weigh in your own health and so forth. If you're imperiling your health and your practice, sometimes it's better to not spread the butter too thin. Does that make sense? You use that expression? With your time and energy and your study and so forth. Okay, so I just wanted to share that. Thanks for reminding me that I had mentioned. I wanted to mention that. So I know I've gone over, and it might even be that you don't have much time left for discussion, but I wanted to just go a little bit further, and I will close my mouth now and leave you. I guess you take a break anyway in between the discussion, if there's any time for discussion. I will see you next time, and we will have our Sunday class. There's a, there is, what, on Sunday Saturday evening there's a par practice, and you're all invited. Enthusiastic perseverance, and see you soon.